Welcome to today's deep dive. If you are joining us right now, it means you're ready to explore something that affects almost every single one of us who interacts with the modern financial system. We are so glad you are here.
Absolutely.
Today, our mission is to unpack some fascinating and honestly slightly terrifying intelligence on the hidden infrastructure that is enabling financial crime. We have a huge stack of insights covering money mule accounts and a concept called account leasing, and we are going to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge for you.
Yeah, because when we think of financial crime, our minds usually go straight to, the Hollywood image.
Right, the ski masks.
Exactly. We picture bank robbers wearing ski masks, demanding cash at gunpoint, or maybe high-tech hackers breaking through firewalls in some dark subterranean basement.
Like in the movies.
But the reality we are looking at today flips that entirely on its head. Today's financial criminals are operating right out in the open, using legally opened, perfectly normal-looking bank accounts to move illicit funds.
Okay, let's unpack this. The core concept here is known in the industry as money mule account provisioning, or account leasing. And it touches on something we all do. We all use banking apps. We all love the convenience of it. But that convenience comes with a massive hidden cost.
What's fascinating here is the core paradox of the situation. Over the last few years, banks have bent over backwards to make things completely seamless for the consumer.
Oh, for sure.
You can open a checking account on your smartphone in 5 minutes while sitting on your couch. You scan your ID, you take a quick selfie, and you're good to go. But those very same digital onboarding channels designed to make banking incredibly easy for you and me have inadvertently created a massive gaping loophole for organized criminal networks.
Wow.
Yeah, the push for frictionless banking has essentially removed the friction for the bad actors, too.
And this is exactly why you, the listener, need to care about this. This isn't just some back office banking problem discussed in corporate boardrooms. This affects everyday people, anyone on social media, and the overall integrity of the global financial system we all rely on. It's happening right under our noses.
It really is.
So let's break down the mechanics of how this actually works. The intelligence lays out a very clear four-step playbook for account leasing. Think of it like renting out your apartment on a weekend to a total stranger you met on the internet. Only instead of handing over the physical keys to your front door, you are handing over the digital keys to your entire financial identity.
That's a great way to put it, because it always starts with a legitimate action. Step one is the setup. An individual opens a brand new bank account, frequently using remote or app-based digital onboarding.
Mm-hmm.
They prove who they are, they scan their actual government-issued ID, they pass all the background checks. From the bank's perspective, a real human being just became a new customer.
Right.
It's all completely real.
But then we get to step two, which happens shortly after activation. The account holder voluntarily hands over access to a third party.
Right.
They might sell their login credentials outright on a dark web forum, or they might share their one-time passwords, those OTP codes you get via text message when you try to log in from a new device. Sometimes they even physically mail their authentication devices or debit cards to a stranger. They are actively letting someone else into the driver's seat of their financial life.
And once the criminals have those keys, they move into step three, the takeover. They move incredibly fast to lock the original owner out and secure their new asset.
They don't waste any time.
Not at all. They jump into the settings and change the contact details, the phone numbers, the email addresses, the physical mailing address. They reset the passwords and the authentication factors. And crucially, they disable all the alerts and security notifications. The original account holder is now completely blind to what happens next.
Which brings us to step four, weaponization. The account is now fully controlled by a criminal network. It just sits there, waiting to receive fraudulent funds. Once the dirty money hits the account, it is rapidly transferred onward to other mule accounts, funneled into cryptocurrency platforms, or pushed out through various cash-out channels. The account has effectively become a vital, untraceable node in a global criminal network.
And a listener might wonder why criminals go to all this trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they want these fresh, newly opened accounts rather than just hacking into old ones or using completely fake, fabricated identities with forged passports?
Yeah, why not just make a fake person?
Because there are some very specific operational advantages to this leasing method. First, consider the transactional history. At inception, a new account has a pristine record and a very low risk score assigned by the bank's algorithm. It hasn't done anything suspicious yet because it hasn't done anything at all.
It's a total blank slate. There's no historical data for the fraud filters to flag.
Add to that the fact that these accounts have legitimate KYC Know Your Customer credentials. A real human being passed the bank's strict identity checks. This builds inherent trust within the global payment ecosystems. When a transaction happens, the receiving institution sees a verified user, not an anonymous red flag.
It can make sense.
Finally, these accounts come with sufficient transaction limits right out of the gate to enable rapid, high-volume fund movement. If a criminal creates a purely synthetic identity, a bank might restrict them to sending $50 a day. A real leased account might let them wire $10,000 in a few taps.
It's essentially a Trojan horse. The bank thinks they have welcomed a new verified customer to their institution, but hidden inside that legitimate digital profile is a sophisticated laundering operation waiting to be activated.
Exactly. These accounts are absolutely vital for what the financial crime industry calls the placement and layering stages of money laundering.
Right.
That is the critical moment when dirty money enters the legitimate financial system and then gets moved around rapidly to obscure its origins. These leased accounts are used heavily to route the proceeds from serious scams. We are talking about phishing attacks, or business email compromise, often referred to as BEC.
Let's pause on that for a second. For anyone unfamiliar, business email compromise is when a scammer infiltrates a company's email system, mimics a vendor or a CEO, and tricks the accounts payable department into paying a massive fake invoice.
And when that company sends the $50,000 for that fake invoice, where does it go? It doesn't go to a criminal's personal bank account. It goes into one of these leased money mule accounts.
Wow.
The same goes for authorized push payment fraud, where individuals are tricked into voluntarily sending their own money to a scammer, thinking they are paying a legitimate bill or helping a family member in distress. The leased account is the receptacle for all that stolen wealth.
That raises a really uncomfortable question. Who are the people actually opening these accounts and handing over the keys? Let's look at the cast of characters involved in this ecosystem. It's not just mastermind hackers operating in isolation. It heavily involves everyday people participating in the system.
Yeah, there are a few distinct profiles we need to look at.
First, you have the unwitting mules. These are people who've been genuinely tricked. They might have responded to a fake job offer online, maybe an advertisement for a payment processing agent working from home. They think they're doing legitimate work by receiving funds and sending them elsewhere, and they don't even realize they are participating in a global money laundering operation.
Moving along the spectrum of intent, you find the complicit mules and the account sellers. These are individuals who knowingly provide access to their accounts in exchange for compensation. They might just be looking to make a quick buck, opening accounts specifically with the intention of selling them on the black market to these networks. They know it's shady, but they turn a blind eye for a flat fee of a few hundred dollars.
And then, scaling all of this up to an industrial level, you have the organized mule farms. This is where groups are running this account provisioning scheme at a massive scale, recruiting hundreds of people to lease their accounts, managing spreadsheets of stolen credentials, and coordinating the flow of millions of dollars.
We really need to look at a critical, much darker detail regarding these organized networks. They don't just recruit anyone randomly off the street. These groups specifically target students, migrants, and financially vulnerable populations to scale their operations.
That is awful.
They prey on people who might be desperate for cash to pay rent or tuition. They also target individuals who might not fully understand the local banking laws or the severe legal ramifications of what they're doing. These networks use vulnerable populations as disposable pawns to build their hidden infrastructure.
It really is a predatory business model. And because this has become such a massive industrialized problem, the financial crime sector has developed specific terminology to track it all. If you are following this space, you will hear investigators talk about account renting, which is pretty self-explanatory. Treating a banked account like a rental car for crime.
Right.
Then there are drop accounts, which are basically the destination accounts where the stolen funds are initially dropped before being scattered. But the most interesting term here is collusive account takeover.
Traditional account takeover implies a hacker broke in against the user's will they guessed a password or intercepted an email. Collusive account takeover means the legitimate account holder actively cooperated with the attacker.
They let them in.
Exactly. They willingly shared the authentication codes or approved the access requests on their phone to let the criminals in. From a cybersecurity perspective, it is incredibly difficult to defend against because the threat is coming from inside the house. The user is authenticating the attacker.
If the user is helping the attacker get in and the account looks perfectly normal when it's open, how do banks actually catch this? What are the digital breadcrumbs? Investigators point out that the first 30 to 90 days of an account's life cycle are a highly critical window.
That early account life cycle is when the mask inevitably starts to slip. The data reveals a series of customer profile changes that act as major red flags. If a bank sees a rapid modification of phone numbers and email addresses right after an account is opened, that's a massive warning sign.
Because normal people don't just change their number the day after they open an account.
Precisely. If the user resets their credentials almost immediately after onboarding, or if they suddenly deactivate all their alerts and communication preferences, essentially trying to make the account run silently in the dark, the bank's monitoring algorithm should be going off.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. It's not just about someone changing a phone number on a Tuesday. It's about the underlying technical anomalies, the digital footprints these criminal networks leave behind while trying to stay hidden. From the bank's fraud dashboard, the activity suddenly looks physically impossible. You start seeing logins coming from geographically distant locations within incredibly short intervals.
The system might register a login from a smartphone on a cellular network in London. 30 minutes later, a login attempt for that exact same account comes from an IP address in Eastern Europe or Southeast Asia. It is physically impossible for the customer to have boarded a plane and traveled that fast.
The criminals know this, of course, so they try to hide their location using technology. They use VPNs, proxy servers, and Tor infrastructure to anonymize where they are actually sitting. For those who don't know, Tor is a network that bounces internet traffic through multiple random servers globally to conceal a user's location.
Yeah, it masks everything.
Plus, they use something called emulator signatures. Instead of using a real physical iPhone or Android device you hold by hand, the criminals use specialized software on a desktop computer that pretends to be a mobile phone. It tries to trick the banking app into thinking it's running on a standard smartphone. The banks have to hunt for these tiny technical ghosts in the machine.
Once the criminals are inside the account and think they have successfully hidden their digital tracks, we see a very specific, aggressive type of transactional behavior. The financial crime community calls this velocity layering.
Wait. If millions of dollars are suddenly bouncing in and out of a college student's checking account, shouldn't that trip a massive alarm at the bank immediately? How does velocity layering actually bypass the system?
It's designed to outpace the system by creating high-speed chaos on a ledger. Velocity layering isn't just one big wire transfer. It looks like this in practice. Funds come into the leased account from multiple, completely unrelated senders in various amounts. The moment that money hits the account, it doesn't sit there to accrue interest. Within minutes or even seconds, it immediately bounces out.
Mm.
There are massive volumes of pass-through activity and a sudden sharp escalation in both the size and the frequency of the transactions.
Just in and out.
Exactly. The money splinters into smaller amounts and is wired to 10 different destinations. By a time a traditional, slower-moving compliance investigator gets an alert and opens the file to look at the suspicious activity, the account balance is already back to zero, and the money is gone.
The real-world anchor to all of this, the thing that really paints a picture of what these accounts are, is what is completely missing from the ledger. When investigators look at these leased accounts, they see zero typical retail spending patterns. Think about your own bank statement. You have $5 coffee purchases, grocery store runs, utility payments, maybe a monthly Netflix subscription. A leased account has none of that. It's an empty shell used exclusively for pure high-speed money movement.
A real human being uses a bank account to live their everyday life. A money mule account is nothing more than a temporary high-pressure pipe for illicit cash.
So, what does this all mean? We've got this massive invisible infrastructure of leased accounts moving stolen money at light speed, hiding behind in the identities of everyday people. The stakes here are incredibly high for the financial institutions. There are several severe institutional risks at play. First, there is massive AML and CFT exposure that's anti-money laundering and combating the financing of terrorism. These accounts are literally the conduits for organized crime and global syndicates.
Absolutely.
Second, there is the direct enablement of fraud. These mule networks are the engine that makes phishing and payment diversion schemes profitable. If criminals can't move the stolen money out of the victim's reach, the scams fundamentally stop working.
From a corporate perspective, the regulatory and reputational risks are staggering. If a bank has weak digital onboarding controls and consistently fails to monitor these leased accounts, they're going to attract intense regulatory scrutiny. We're talking about severe enforcement actions, public censures, and fines that can run into the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Huge numbers.
And furthermore, if a bank becomes publicly known as a haven for criminal fund flows, it completely undermines institutional trust. Customers don't want to keep their life savings in a bank that is essentially functioning as a laundromat for international crime syndicates.
If the enemy looks just like a normal customer, with a real ID and a real face, how do the banks actually fight back? What is the defense strategy against an insider threat?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, banks cannot rely on a single checkpoint at the front door anymore. They have to employ a multi-layered defense strategy, a full lifecycle approach to mitigation. It starts with completely overhauling and strengthening digital onboarding. Banks are now deploying advanced biometric verification and liveness detection.
We've all probably experienced this recently. Liveness detection is when the banking app makes you hold your phone up, asks you to blink, turn your head to the left, or smile right. It's making sure you are a real, breathing human being in that exact moment, not just a static photograph of an ID or a deep fake video generated by AI.
Exactly that. They are also using behavioral analytics during the identity verification steps themselves. The app is quietly tracking how a user types on the keyboard, how they hold the phone, the angle of the gyroscope. They are deploying advanced device intelligence to spot those emulator signatures we talked about earlier, ensuring the app is running on a real piece of hardware.
But the defense doesn't stop once the account is open. There is an intense need for ongoing early life account monitoring, especially during that critical 30 to 90 day window where the account takeover usually happens. Banks have to implement strict device binding. This means the account is digitally tethered to your specific physical smartphone. If a login attempt happens from a brand new device halfway across the country, it triggers step-up verification protocols. The bank might temporarily freeze the account and demand a new facial scan or a phone call to verify it's really you.
They also heavily monitor for those geolocation anomalies and use dynamic risk triggers for any sudden changes in contact details. On a macro level, investigators have to use network and mule detection analytics. They can't just look at one single account in isolation anymore. They have to look at the entire forest. They look at beneficiary clustering.
Beneficiary clustering.
Yeah. Imagine 50 seemingly unrelated checking accounts, all owned by different people, all suddenly sending small bursts of money to the exact same obscure destination account. That clustering is a massive red flag. They analyze the velocity and layering patterns across thousands of transactions, and they correlate shared devices and credentials across multiple accounts.
Yeah.
And where the regulatory environment allows for it, interbank intelligence sharing, it's crucial.
So they can't just jump ship.
Exactly. Banks need to talk to each other so that a criminal network can't just hop from one institution to another using the exact same tactics once they get shut down.
Even with all this incredible technology, the biometric scans and the network analytics, there is a massive enforcement dilemma that these financial crime teams face every single day. When the alarms go off and an investigation triggers, the bank has to figure out exactly who they are dealing with on the other side of the screen.
This is perhaps the most difficult challenge in the entire space, the human element. Investigators have to distinguish between an unwitting participant, someone who is genuinely tricked by a sophisticated fake job scam and thought they were doing legitimate work, and a deliberate, complicit facilitator who knowingly leased their account to a syndicate for profit.
And that distinction dictates everything that happens next in the real world. It determines whether the account simply gets closed gently to protect a victim from further harm, or if it triggers serious suspicious activity reporting and direct collaboration with federal law enforcement to prosecute the account holder. Distinguishing between a victim and a criminal is absolutely critical for a proportional response and for the bank's regulatory defensibility.
It requires investigators to look beyond the cold hard code and try to determine human intent. That is an incredibly complex, sometimes impossible task when all you have to go on are digital breadcrumbs and IP addresses.
To summarize the core tension we've explored today, the banking industry's massive push for seamless digital accessibility has been a double-edged sword. It made life incredibly convenient for you and me, allowing us to manage our finances from anywhere in the world. But it also inadvertently created a vast hidden infrastructure for global financial crime. To fight back, banks can no longer just be static vaults holding our money. They have to become high-tech behavioral detectives, constantly monitoring the digital body language of their own customers to ensure the person logging in is who they say they are.
It is a relentless, constant arms race between convenience for the consumer and security for the system.
As we wrap up this deep dive, we want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building directly on the themes from today's intelligence. Think about that delicate balance between security and accessibility, and the human cost behind it all. We discussed how distinguishing between an unwitting participant and a deliberate facilitator is critical for a proportional response. But consider this: if a real, legitimate account holder is financially vulnerable enough to be recruited by an organized mule farm, maybe they are desperate to pay next month's rent and they hand over their authentication codes, how can behavioral analytics and device binding ever truly determine what's happening in the human heart behind the screen? At what point does the cold mathematical algorithm decide you are no longer a struggling victim of circumstance, but a complicit facilitator in a global crime syndicate?
It is a profound question about the intersection of technology, human vulnerability, and the absolute limits of data.
We encourage you to ponder that question the next time you open a banking app on your phone, scan your face, and seamlessly transfer some cash. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive into the hidden infrastructure of financial crime. We will catch you next time.